From the Los Angeles Times, this is The Envelope, the podcast, your ultimate guide to award season. I'm one of your hosts, Mark Olson.
And I'm your other host, Yvonne Villarreal. Every week, our podcast showcases key voices across both TV and film.
How's it going, Yvonne?
I'm like struggling with this weather, Mark. Like, it has me in this weird mindset of, should I be snuggled in my bed or should I be out at the park? It's a lot of mixed messages here. How are you?
Probably the same. This isn't quite June gloom, but it feels that way. And so, yeah, it's got me a little confused.
Very confused.
But now, one thing I think we do know, who are you talking to this week, Yvonne?
Well, this week I'm speaking with Stephen Canals, the showrunner of the FX drama Pose. The series explores the extravagant subculture of the LGBTQ ballroom scene in New York in the 1980s and 90s. Pose is in its third and final season, and I asked Stephen what he thought the impact of the show would be on TV and entertainment, since so much of the show is about the legacy you leave behind. Here's what he said.
I almost don't know if I should say this out loud. I said this to someone privately the other day, and I was like, I'll just say it. I hope that the legacy of the show is that years from now, we will look back and say that was where change began.
You know, it's funny, Yvonne. People, I think, always obviously care about the shows that they do and that we talk to them about. But something with your conversation with Stephen, like, it seems so much more meaningful to him and in a deep way that, like, it's emotional and surprising and really moving to hear him talk about the show.
Well, when a community is starved for representation, a lot does ride on shows or projects when, you know, their time is up. So yeah, I think a lot of people are really wondering what happens next, what happens from here. So it'll be interesting to see what does happen.
And we'll be back with Yvonne's conversation with Stephen after this quick break.
Hey everyone, Tim Cash here, host of Prime Video Presents, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of your favorite Amazon originals. Now, I know we've all been watching a ton of TV shows and movies in this past year, and if you're anything like me, you've turned on the incredible slate of Amazon originals on Prime Video. Whenever I finish watching a show or film, I always want to hear the behind-the-scenes stories of how these ideas were brought to life. And that is exactly what we do on Prime Video Presents. Join me for conversations with legendary director and writer Steve McQueen about how he created his fantastic anthology series, Small Axe. First-time creator Little Marvin on his smash hit horror series, Them. Paul Bettany and Alan Ball on one of my favorite movies this year, Uncle Frank, and many more. It all starts May 7th, right here on Prime Video Presents. Subscribe now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back to The Envelope. Here's Yvonne's conversation with Stephen Canals, the showrunner of the FX drama Pose.
Stephen, thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I have to say, people are not ready for this story to be over. Mm. Have you gotten that sense from seeing the reaction?
I have. Yeah. I think a lot of folks were surprised. And I've had a lot of individuals, including friends and family, reach out to ask, you know, were you all canceled? And you know, I think the reality is at this point, like, everyone's going to believe what they want to believe. The truth is that we were not canceled. You know, it was a very intentional choice on our part, our being myself and Ryan Murphy and Brad Falchuk, and really in conversation with the whole room. Janet Mock and Our Lady J were part of that conversation as well. But just an intentional choice on our part to allow the story to naturally end where we'd always intended for it to end. You know, so the truth is, Ryan and I had a conversation very shortly after we first met and decided that we were going to collaborate on this project together. And immediately we knew exactly what the end was going to be. And we talked about it and we stuck to that. I understand the disappointment of it's only three seasons, but there was a very specific narrative that from the very inception of this, from this idea, you know, that I wanted to tell. And I got to tell it. And that's really wonderful. And, you know, I know that the audience probably won't feel this way, but the truth is that they were a large part of the reason that we decided to end it early. Because I think the truth is that had we made the decision to stretch the story out to 4 or 5 or even 6 seasons, which we absolutely could have done, I just think that we would have become that show that folks would have just started to drop off. In truth, I think that that's what happens to a lot of series, right? It's like, you know, I don't think it's by chance that a lot of the shows that we love so much, they're ending, you know, in what audiences consider to be too soon. You know, it's like there's a clear end in sight and there it is. And that's what we're barreling toward. And I just didn't want us to create a third season that felt like filler. That is the truth about why the story ended now. It's just, oh, the ending is there. And so do we just allow ourselves to write to the end? Or do we create a season that's just filler, you know, to then belabor us getting to the very end? And I just, in my mind, I kept seeing, and this shouldn't have been the full barometer, but I just envision like the true fans of the show watching it and being like, what is this? Like, why is this what you're giving us? I'm really proud of this final season, and I think that the audience will be as well.
And Ryan is Ryan Murphy, who is one of the co-creators of the show. Well, you were in production on season 3 before the pandemic put it on pause, and then obviously everything sort of came to a halt. So was it always the plan to have it be the final season, or did COVID sort of accelerate the timeline of the narrative? Like, you found ways of, we can do this with that sort of in mind now. How did COVID change the shape of the season?
Very little, to be honest. I suppose eagle-eyed audience members will clock choices that we had to make because of the pandemic. I think you'll feel it the most in terms of like camera angles and you know, certain choices that we had to make, because obviously we couldn't populate our show in the way that we have in the past. You know, we were very limited. I think the greatest example of that is like our ball scenes in the previous 2 seasons. We had anywhere from 125 to 150 background actors. And this season, we were limited. We were never allowed to have more than like 35 people total. And so, you know, like, think about that. Like, how do you populate a ballroom and make it look full with so few bodies? And so we had to get very creative to work around that. And I think we did a really good job. I honestly, in truth, I don't think the audience will feel any difference.
I was going to say, I've seen all 7 episodes, and I'm sort of struck that you said that because I didn't notice. So talk to me about what it did take to make it so most viewers won't notice the change.
Again, the camera angles was a big part of it. We worked really closely with a wonderful VFX company, and they aided in creative solutions to populate the show. So there are moments where you've seen the finale. So in the finale, we have there's a protest that takes place, and you see 2 groups of people walking down the street, and then they all converge. Like, that was shot in like segments. And so we would like bring people in and then shoot a group of like 30 and then shoot another group of 30. And then in post, we were able to put them all together and make it look like a large group of 250 people. But the truth is that that was filmed in different smaller segments. And so that, I think, is probably the area where we had to make the biggest adjustment. But narratively, the story that you experienced this 3rd season is what we intended for it to be prior to the pandemic, which I'm really proud of. And it's interesting because in a lot of ways, I think this season, and especially the finale, I think very directly addresses everything that's happening in our country right now, specifically with the pandemic. It wasn't that we went back and retrofitted the narrative. I think a lot of people probably will watch and assume that that was what happened. And the reality is, no, that's the ending that you see for this series is what Ryan and I had always talked about the ending being. And it just so happens that it's urgent.
I mean, this is a very unique experience. You're putting your first show to rest. at the same time as a pandemic is causing all these changes to what can be done, how do you look back on that experience of getting it all sort of put together?
It was a lot of work. It's my first honest reaction. It was a lot of work. You know, this season in particular was tough because we were filming it in the middle of a pandemic. You know, there were restrictions in terms of the amount of people that we could have on set. We had less time to shoot the show, so our hours were shortened. You know, we obviously were having to take a lot of breaks, you know, because you're spending, particularly like for myself and for Janet Mock, who she and I directed 6 out of the 7 episodes this season. You know, we were spending upwards of 13 hours a day in a face mask and then a shield as well. You know, and then when you get into the actual practical parts of directing, it's tough to have that intimacy and that connection with your actors when you're trying to give them a note, when you're hyper aware that you're like, we don't want to be too close to one another. And then the other thing is with all of the PPE that you're wearing, it's really hard for them to hear you. And so then you're trying to create like a intimate moment so that you can share a note, for example. And so it was difficult. I think we were also hyper aware that on top of the pandemic, obviously last summer, we were also dealing with or having a reckoning with the deaths of Black people in our country at the hands of law enforcement. And so in the midst of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd and Ahmaud Arbery and all these other deaths that were happening, we were also hyper aware of the importance of our visibility as a show, as Black and Afro-Latinx people. It made the work feel that much more important, but it also made it that much more emotional. You know, I couldn't wait for, and I can't wait for the world to see this season, because I think a lot of what we're talking about is so critically important, especially at this time. And then the other piece of that is something that you addressed in your question, which is the feeling of like, should we have just kept going? Because, you know, there are so many other important things that are happening in the world. And we can use our show to continue to be not just a beacon of light and hope, but also as a platform to express all of the things that are happening. I'm hyper aware of that. And I think coming off of this third season, I just want to make sure that I continue to use my privilege and the platform that I have as a show creator to continue to highlight those stories that hopefully engage audiences in important discourses.
You've talked before about how you wrote the pilot in 2014 and spent like 2 years being told it was too niche, too urban, and not commercial. And I think there was the story of you getting like 100 no's from executives. What kept you going? What kept you from giving up? And I guess also like once it was sold, how do you keep all those no's from causing any doubt about how it will be received?
Well, I learned the resilience from my family. You know, I think as I've always said, I think for those of us who are Black or Latinx or Asian, it comes in the kit. You know, the moment that you're born, it's like resilience is part of your it's part of your birthright. You know, it's like we just know, okay, we're born into a world, you know, that tells us that we are less than, you know, and so we have to work that much harder than our white counterparts to be seen, to be heard, to take up space unapologetically. You know, that sense of persistence and that willingness to continue to forge ahead in the face of all the no's didn't feel in the moment like a lot of work. When I reflect on it now, it boggles my mind to think that I had 166 meetings before in this industry before finally meeting Sherry Marsh, who was the executive producer who introduced me to Ryan Murphy. You know, and that was over the course of 2.5 years. When I say that out loud, I'm like, wow, yeah, that was a really long time. And there was a lot of ups and downs and peaks and valleys throughout that journey. But in the moment, as I was walking through it, you know, and there certainly were disappointing moments and moments where I thought, okay, it's done. Okay, fine. Let's do something else. But the truth is that it didn't feel as taxing as I think people imagine it to be, because the reality is, like, for us as, you know, Black and brown people in this country, like, we're constantly having to forge ahead in the face of adversity. It didn't feel all that unfamiliar, which is sad for me to say out loud when I really sit and think about that. It's, like, disappointing. I imagine that a lot of people listening to this conversation will be nodding their heads and thinking, mm-hmm, I get it, you know? And it's just, it's, that is sad to me. But the reality is that it just, I don't know any other way of being. And I think the fact of the matter is, like, I feel so ultra privileged to be working in this industry right now. And to know that for me as, like, a young, as an Afro-Puerto Rican who grew up in housing projects in the Bronx in the 1980s, to get from there to here, to be a show creator and to have the opportunity to tell story, and that's the thing I get paid to do, is so massively huge. The person who I always think about first and foremost is my abuelita, who died about 2 months ago, who migrated to New York City in the late 50s, in her 20s, not knowing English, from Puerto Rico, with not one, but three little girls, all under the age of 4 years old. One of those little girls being my mom. And managed, again, to just, with the lack of resources that she had, make a life for her kids. And so if in the face of all the adversity that she had to deal with, in addition to being in an abusive relationship with my grandfather, that she could still find a way to forge ahead, then I have no excuse to say that I'm tired because I have to walk into several rooms to pitch a story. I don't even know what tired means. She knows what tired means. I don't.
First, I just want to say I'm so sorry for your loss. That's fairly recent.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, she actually passed away halfway through the production of the finale.
Oh, Steven.
You've seen the finale, so obviously there was a lot of me pulling in all of the experience and the emotion and everything that I was feeling. I poured all of that into the episode.
I feel like there was a lot of that, particularly with this year that we've been having. I know MJ, when we spoke last year, right as production stopped, she was going through her own personal stuff with a family member. The way that you all have rallied to get this sort of done in spite of how you're grieving, I can't imagine what that's like.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was, you know, the loss of my grandmother was tough because she really was she co-parented me. You know, I spent as much time, I'm actually interested, if I added up all the time, I wonder, I probably spent more time at my grandmother's than my own place, frankly. You know, I lived in my grandmother's apartment. She was another mom and was so critically important to me and to my life. And we had a really special relationship because we're the two Virgos in the family. And so we, you know, we understand that special brand of Virgo neuroses that nobody else does. And so, you know, we had our own very special connection and bond. But production is, it's so much work and it's so exhausting. And I think dealing with an emotional loss and grieving the loss of my grandmother was something that I think on a good day, I probably would have just folded up and allowed myself to be sad about it all. But I don't know, there was something really special for me about her passing in the midst of me directing the finale. I don't know, I think the loss of her just emboldened me to get back to set and to rally and finish this episode in her honor. You know, like, that's the thing, is like, I truly feel like I live in the shadows of her sacrifices. And so the reality is that I was like, I have to get back to work because every single choice that she made in her life for my mom and for my aunts and my uncles, all of that trickled down to me and to all of the other grandkids and great-grandkids. And so the best thing that I can do in honoring her life is to continue to do the work that I'm doing, because I know that I'm where I'm at because she made all these sacrifices so that I could be here.
You got to keep living the life that's bigger than what you thought you could.
Absolutely.
Because of her. Well, the AIDS epidemic looms large in season 3. And in this week's episode, Pray Tell, who's played by the great Billy Porter, he's contending with unexpected health burdens. What can you tell us about what you wanted to explore with that character?
Pray Tell, I think, has such a beautiful arc this season. You know, we were, as a writer's room, hyper aware that in grounding our narrative in 1994, that we were also at a point where we were seeing the epidemic at its height. And I think for Pray Tell, and obviously the audience has already seen this and experienced this via the first 2 episodes of the season, you know, he is really feeling the impact of the loss within the community. And so we wanted to, through Pray Tell, explore what is the deep impact for an individual who is not only dealing with the loss of their community, but is also having to fight the very thing that is eviscerating everyone. And what's the emotional impact and the fallout of all of that? You know, like, how does one forge ahead? You know, how does a person make the choice to continue to live even when all roads are pointing elsewhere? And that was really important. That was important for us to explore what that looks like through Pray.
You were in, what, like your teens during this period that we're seeing in this season? Like, what do you remember about that time? And what do you remember about what you were hearing and reading about what was going on?
Yeah, I remember everyone around me being hyper-vigilant. So I was born in 1980. So I was very young, obviously, when we first found out about HIV and when there was still so much myths and misinformation. But by the time I was 8 years old, we had already lost a family friend to AIDS. You know, he happened to be an intravenous drug user. And I remember seeing him. He had a lesion on his face. And I remember seeing him and wondering, like, oh, what is that? You know, it wasn't explained to me until after he'd passed away. And even then, it's really fascinating. I have a memory of my mom and I going to the supermarket, and I was 8 years old, so I was like 3rd grade. But I remember seeing his wife and one of his children in the grocery store. And my mother, at that point, we didn't even know that he had passed away. I remember my mother asked, how is he doing? And his wife broke down and said he died. But at the time, what we were told was that he had a lung infection. So they weren't even acknowledging what it was. You know, it took a little while later for us to realize, no, he had a lesion. Like, he died of HIV, he died of AIDS. So I was always hyper aware of, and obviously everyone was so fearful. Like, I can recall being in grade school and being told by our teachers, and I was younger than 8 at that point. I think I had to have been like maybe 7. But I remember specifically we were told by our teachers, like, if anybody's ever bleeding, like, do not help them. And I remember going home and having a conversation with my mom, who's a kindergarten teacher, and being so confused. Like, wait, I thought if we were told that someone was hurt, we're supposed to help, like, we're supposed to intervene, and not being able to wrap my brain around and understand, like, if there's blood involved, if someone's hurt in that way, you do not help, and not understanding why. And obviously, once I got older, I understood where that was coming from, right? But again, there was all these myths and all this misinformation about HIV, and that was impacting how people were interacting with each other and how we were navigating the world. And so all that to say that by the time I was 14, so I was 14 in 1994, which is where we are now in our series, I was in high school at this point. And I remember the big sort of brouhaha when I started my first year of high school was that my high school decided they wanted to start handing out condoms so that folks were having safe sex. And I remember that was a huge deal. The PTA was involved. I remember in my high school, there were a lot. And this was in the South Bronx, by the way. There were still all these conversations around, like, what does it mean for us to be giving condoms to high school students, to kids who are 14 to 18 years old? You know, are we encouraging them to go out and have sex? That's my recollection and my understanding of this time period, outside of being aware that for a lot of folks, particularly in my South Bronx community, the belief still was, if you're gay, you're going to get AIDS and you're going to die. And I think the only reason why, at least in my family, we didn't truly believe that to be the truth or the case is that, like I said, we had a family friend who was straight and who had died of AIDS. And, you know, that wasn't his narrative. But I know that that belief that if you were gay, that was what your journey was going to be, it permeated everywhere.
More of Yvonne's conversation with Stephen Canals is coming up next. Stay with us.
Hey everyone, Tim Cash here, host of Prime Video Presents, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of your favorite Amazon originals. Now, I know we've all been watching a ton of TV shows and movies in this past year, and if you're anything like me, you've turned on the incredible slate of Amazon originals on Prime Video. Whenever I finish watching a show or film, I always want to hear the behind-the-scenes stories of how these ideas were brought to life. And that is exactly what we do on Prime Video Presents. Join me for conversations with legendary director and writer Steve McQueen about how he created his fantastic anthology series, Small Axe. First-time creator Little Marvin on his smash hit horror series, Them. Paul Bettany and Alan Ball on one of my favorite movies this year, Uncle Frank, and many more. It all starts May 7th, right here on Prime Video Presents. Subscribe now for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back to The Envelope. Here's the rest of Yvonne's conversation with the showrunner of Pose, Stephen Canals.
Okay, Stephen, I want to talk about this week's episode. I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the episode will feature an epic trio of guest stars. Anna Maria Horsford plays Praytell's mother. You have Janet Hubert and Jack K. Harry. Just tell me everything about having those women together.
Oh, so great. It was the moment that we discussed having an episode where Pray was going to go home and reconnect with his mom. We knew that we needed to have some really important, epic talent to come in and guest star. And so we spent time being really intentional about who we would cast in those roles. You know, like, who would the audience be really excited to see? Specifically in the case of, like, Jack Hay, you know, we referenced 227 in season one of the show. You know, like, we have, I think Lulu talks about 227 in the second episode. So
for the youth who are listening, 227 was an 80s sitcom set in Northeast Washington, D.C., starring Jack Hay. And Jack Hay, as we just heard, is also in the third season of Pose.
We knew that the audience would be really excited to see these women. And they're all great. And they're important, not just to the culture, but also their work still means so much. Like, each one of those women has starred in a television show that today we still talk about. Like, they're all part of classic television. You know, like, as a little boy, when I first met Anna Maria, the first thing I told her was, when I was a little boy, I was obsessed with Amen. And I used to dance around anytime the theme song came on. Like, I would be dancing in the living room for my mom. You know, I'd be performing because I love that show so much. So, you know, having all of them was great. And they had such a beautiful camaraderie and rapport. And obviously, Billy was super excited to work with them, too. So it was great.
You've tackled a lot of heavy subjects in the series. Is there a storyline that you can't believe you got away with doing or that made your collaborators nervous?
Gosh, that's so interesting. FX has been a wonderful network to collaborate with. They really never push back on anything. Funny enough, I will say, I think that I was the person who on the page was always being very conservative. And Ryan Murphy was constantly having to remind me, like, you need to push that a little further. I think the best example of that was, like, in the first season, in the second episode, when Blanca has a conversation about sex with Damon. I would say, like, that was the sort of, I think, watershed moment for me anyway, as a storyteller, because I was like, can we talk about this on television? Like, can we really go there? And, like, the first draft that I wrote was like, it was very, like, it kind of read like a pamphlet that you would find in like a doctor's office. Like, it was just, it was very mechanical and didn't feel real and organic. And Ryan was like, what is this? He was like, why are you not writing this the way that you would have wished your parents had spoken to you? And I was like, I just don't know. Like, can we really talk about like gay sex in this way on TV? Like, we're really going to talk about bottoming, for example? And he's like, yeah, go there, go all the way there. And we did. And the network didn't balk. Like, they never came back and said, like, you have to change this. So you have to. So the answer to your question is like, no, there really wasn't anything that I felt like, I can't believe we're going there. Because if anything, I think between Ryan and the network, they were constantly pushing us to go further.
Hmm. Well, I was going to ask you, like, how you think this show shaped you as a storyteller, even how it got you thinking about the audience through the run of the series. Because here is this mainstream show that revolves around the LGBTQ community, particularly the trans community, and their perspective on a narrative might be different than the average viewer. Like, there's the season one storyline with Evan Peters, who plays a cisgender married businessman, Stan. And he has this complicated relationship with Angel, who is played by India Moore. I know you've talked before about how important it was to sort of let viewers, particularly trans viewers, know that Angel was going to be fine, because the expectation or the fear was that Stan was going to be violent toward her, because that's what plays out more often than not in the real world. So talk about how it got you thinking about who's watching and how they're going to, you know, view the narrative.
That's a great question. You know, I will say, I don't think that we made the choice intentionally to be subversive. Like, it wasn't like we were saying, okay, we want to tell a story and then suddenly decided, like, what's the subversive version of this narrative? Like, that wasn't the case. For us, it was just always grounding the narrative in truth. We recognized that there was a huge responsibility in telling the story, because we were centering lives that often are not centered. And specifically when we're talking about the queer and trans community, so often, more often than not, our narratives are rooted in our traumas. And so we made a very intentional choice right from the beginning to not do that. And so it's interesting, because I think so often when I'm talking to folks about the show, they're always like, the show is so subversive and it's so different. I'm like, it really isn't. It's just, we're showing this other side that you all never get to see, because historically in film and television, we've always focused on the trauma, right? And here, what we decided to do is to focus on the joy, you know? And that's not to say that we didn't shy away from the hardships, because we absolutely did. But I think in the case of our show, and this is the importance of telling the full scope of a life and looking at stories intersectionally, our characters are not solely queer and not solely trans. They also happen to be brown and black, and they happen to be working class. They have all these other identities that are impacting not only the way that they see the world, but the way that the world sees them, and how they then are navigating their environment. That was the guide for the story, you know? And so it wasn't like we went into the narrative saying, oh, you know, we're gonna tell a story where a cis man falls in love with a trans woman, and the subversive version of that is that she's not going to die, you know, and he isn't going to hit her. It was less that, and it was more so, what is the version of that story that we have never seen before, you know, and what is the truth, right? Because the reality is, the number of trans women who have approached me to say that season one storyline, you know, I've had plenty of stands in my life, you know? And so the reality is, like, that narrative, absolutely, it's not like that's special to pose. It's like, no, there are a lot of women, trans women, who are having that experience. You all have just chosen not to tell that story. It's taking the spotlight that's always shined a light in one direction and just gently moving it in another direction and saying, hey, there's a whole other narrative and a whole group of people who are having an experience that you've never centered, and we want to tell that story.
Without giving anything away, How did that sort of view and approach shape what you wanted that finale to be? Like how you wanted things to end, on what note you wanted things to end, without giving anything away?
If you go back to the first season, specifically the pilot, when we first meet Blanca, she is diagnosed with HIV. And everything that the audience needs to know about what choices we were going to make on our show live in that scene for me. Because historically, HIV/AIDS has always been a death sentence. And we were very intentionally making a decision to say, it doesn't have to be a death sentence. And in spite of the fact that, you know, these Black and brown, queer and trans people who have very little resources at their disposal and are dealing with a lack of access to healthcare, for example, are having to navigate this disease that is eviscerating their community, they're still going to find the love and the joy and the connection to family, and they're going to live a life. You know, Blanca's decision in that pilot to say, I want to leave a legacy behind and I want to create a family and I'm going to form a house. Like that to me is what grounds the entire series. And so I think the finale, it honors that choice that we made right at the beginning, which is to say, yes, HIV/AIDS is absolutely something that the world is still contending with. You know, we have not found a cure yet. And HIV/AIDS does not have to be a death sentence. If you are someone who is living with HIV, you absolutely are still deserving of love and you deserve to take up space unapologetically and you deserve to have your voice heard. I hope that that's the message that people take away from the finale.
I have to say, images for the season began making the rounds on social media. And folks really latched onto the one of Electra, Blanca, Angel, and Lulu that was sort of reminiscent of Sex and the City. Yeah. Was it important for you to sort of redefine or reboot that imagery? And like, what did you think of how much it resonated with people?
It's always so funny to me what the audience and what people are going to respond to. Like, I had that experience last season when I directed episode 8. And there's that moment in the middle of the big family argument post Damon's graduation where Electra goes, ooh, and it became a gif and everybody thought it was so funny. And I was like, well, it's so interesting to me that that's the thing that people love so much. Or like that epic read that Electra has in the girls trip episode in episode 9. So I was fascinated that that moment sort of exploded in the way that it did. And yet it kind of makes sense to me. You know, it's like you're seeing all of these beautiful Black and brown trans women looking fabulous, walking down the street, and you can see and feel the joy in that moment. And I have to say that that joy was real because I think the ladies really genuinely do love and care for one another. And so that moment in particular, we shot that in Soho, and it was freezing that morning because we shot that at 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. Like, it was so cold. It was so cold. And you see what they're wearing. But they were just, like, smiling and walking and looking fabulous. And so it's funny to me. Again, I loved the moment, and I thought it was so beautiful, and I love it in the episode. You know, and it's so important to see that visual. It's interesting. I wonder how many people who love that visual so much love it specifically because it happens to be for trans women that they're seeing, and that it has less to do with, you know, its connection to Sex and the City, you know, because I mean, we've seen plenty of images of girlfriends together walking. And so it's fascinating to me that this image of these particular four women is one that's so beautiful and one that people love so much. But I think it says a lot to me anyway. Not to get super deep, but I think it says a lot about what images are often being broadcast and what we see. And I think the reality of it is, like, do you typically see Black trans women in communion in that way?
Well, it's like they're taking up that space that is so often relegated to white women on screen. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, yeah, I think that's why it really hit people.
And they look fabulous.
And they looked fabulous, seriously. Well, as you said, like, so, you know, with Blanca, so much of what she thinks about is her legacy. And so much of the show is about legacy, like what you leave behind and how you pave a sort of path forward for the next generation. What do you hope is the show's sort of impact on the future of TV and entertainment?
I almost don't know if I should say this out loud. I said this to someone privately the other day, and I was like, I'll just say it. I hope that the legacy of the show is that years from now, we will look back and say that was where change began. You know, I think that there was never a show like this prior to this moment. And the reality is, to be perfectly honest with you, Fawn, like, I don't actually even feel like the thing that we did is that groundbreaking in truth. I know it's going to be crazy to hear for some people, but it's like, in so many ways, it feels like we did the thing that we just are always supposed to be doing as storytellers. Like, story is about connecting us all as people. And so Latinx people and Black people and queer people and trans people and folks who happen to hold both of those identities, you know, like, we're out in the world and we take up space and we're part of the population just like everybody else. And so that we weren't being seen, I get why Pose means so much and what it represents and why it is considered groundbreaking, you know, because we'd never seen anything like it before. But in my mind, it's like, but we should have been. And so, I don't know, there's a part of me that feels like it's always really strange to get the accolades for being at the center of creating the show that's, you know, done that for the first time, because it's like, well, we should have always been doing it. I feel deeply in my heart, I just hope that we're not the last.
Like, I think that's where a lot of the worry is about losing a show like this. Like, it's created such a sort of sacred space. And, you know, this was a show that featured the largest cast of trans actors in TV history. Like, 5 of the series regulars were trans women of color. And how do we keep those actors on screen on other projects? How do we make sure those gains are not lost? Like, what would you tell Hollywood executives?
You know, well, the first thing I would say is, like, continue to, A, cast these women in roles, and the men too, you know, because our show is also populated with a bunch of queer men, Billy Porter and DeLon Burnside and Ryan Jamal Swain. And so, you know, Jason Rodriguez, I would encourage folks to continue to cast these incredible actors in roles. And the other really important piece of all of this is continue to bring in, or not even to continue, let's say start to bring in queer and trans people of color who have stories to tell. Because the reality is, like, we're out here in the world and, you know, we're writing and we're acting and we just need the opportunity. You know, I think the reason why I'm not fearful about the end of Pose and what happens moving forward is that we all are now here and doing it, right? And so I have a deal at 20th, and Janet Mock signed a deal at Netflix, and all of these incredible actors now have been on red carpets and they've been on the covers of magazines. And, you know, I think people know who they are now. And so the reality is that now that we're here, it's just a matter of us continuing to do really great work, you know, that centers our voices and centers our community.
Well, and we know from past experience, you do not take no for an answer. So there's that too.
Correct.
Well, before we wrap, Stephen, you know, we've been taking this time to also ask the people we speak with about the things that they've been watching during this time. There's a little bit more of the opportunity to watch things that you otherwise wouldn't have been able to. Are there things that you've been binging or watching that you recommend?
I just finished watching Generation on HBO Max. I think I'm just a sucker for, like, a good teen show. I mean, I grew up with, like, Felicity and Dawson's Creek and 90210. And, you know, anyway, so all that to say that I still, even to this day, like, I love Euphoria and I love Sex Education, and Generation has a very queer sensibility. It's funny and heartbreaking, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was so good. So I hope everyone checks that out.
Very well. Well, that's a good recommendation. I want to thank you again for taking the time. It was such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. It was great talking to you, too.
So, Yvonne, what really stuck out for you about that conversation?
Well, I'm just like sort of impressed and amazed that he was able to really focus on something as big as the final season of Pose while dealing with grief. Like, you know, I think it's something we've all experienced in some form or fashion during this time of having to, you know, do and focus on work while mentally we're not all there. And the fact that he was able to deliver something, I think, that is as meaningful as the finale of Pose, I can't complain anymore is what I took away from that. But also, like, you know, series finales, there's a lot always riding on them, and you have to think about what you're delivering to audiences. And for him, there's that position of wanting not to end with trauma, but also showing joy, like, especially during this period when there was so much going on. And the way that he managed to do that, I think a lot of people will be talking about. What about you?
Well, I thought it was interesting how he is kind of a fan and student of television himself. And so the way he talked about Sex and the City, and, you know, the way that he sort of, like, there are things he purposely kind of grabbed from, ideas he has, you know, wants to Pose to be sort of in conversation with it a little bit. I found that really fascinating.
And like I told you, Mark, I think I told you this last week, episode 6, I just need you to watch it so we can discuss this in depth, because I want to know if you had the same emotions I had watching it. Not to hype it too much. I don't want you to have like these high expectations, but like I watched it a few times. That's how much I couldn't get enough of it.
I'll be sure to mark my calendar for when episode 6 is going to air. But now as we wrap up, what else have you been watching this week?
Okay, so this is now going to be like my new obsession. I was already obsessed with her, but I watched the new late night talk show from Z-Way that's on Showtime. And for those who don't know, Z-Way is a, you know, a writer, comedian, and internet sensation. You know, she has a YouTube series called Baited, where she sort of became known for asking pointed questions about race. And it's something that she carried over during her celebrity interviews on Instagram Live. Anyway, the first episode, she had Fran Lebowitz in the hot seat, which was great. And she had a segment where she interviewed real life Karens. That was hilarious. And she ended the first episode with an interview with Gloria Steinem, where she read her the lyrics to Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion's WAP song. So it doesn't get better than that.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to see the Z-Way show yet, but I'm excited to, because I know among her collaborators are both Julio Torres and Patty Harrison, who both were involved in the movie Together Together that came out recently that I was a big fan of. Patty Harrison is fantastic in that movie, so I'm excited to see them both on Z-Way's show as well.
Yes, and you know, I can't let us talk without me mentioning another HGTV series. Mark, you know, like, I'm in this space of like, I'm sick of my apartment and everything in it, and I just watch these shows to escape. And there's a show called Farmhouse Fixer with Jonathan Knight, who I hope you know is a member of New Kids on the Block. So it's everything I need it to be. Have you heard of this show? You haven't.
No.
I can see from your face, you're like, no. Well, okay, so tell me what you've been watching.
There recently was the TCM Classic Film Festival, which usually is like an in-person event here in Los Angeles. It's right. Really like a very fun, you know, series of events. But it's virtual this year, broadcasting both on the Turner Classic Movies cable channel and also with stuff you could stream on HBO Max. And one of the things that showed on TCM was Grease 2, which I was excited about for many reasons. I actually had never seen it before. You know, it's a sequel, obviously, to Grease. It came out in 1982. It was like kind of a breakout role for a young Michelle Pfeiffer. But also the cast is sort of nuts. Lorna Luft is in it. Connie Stevens and Tab Hunter. Actually, a very young Pamela Adlon is in the cast, yes, as well. And it also, the movie just has this sort of like crazy, very kind of like Mamma Mia energy, because it was directed by Patricia Birch, who was the choreographer of the original film. So it really is just this madcap, like, dance movie that I don't want to get into, like, comparing, you know, Grease and Grease 2, but it definitely, Grease 2 has an energy all its own, even though it was a bit of a bomb when it came out, but it just has, like, over the years, people have really grown to love it. And
yeah, it has a cult following.
Yeah, very much so. And you can completely see why. And it also, it's funny in that I keep wondering, as you're watching it, it's as if Michelle Pfeiffer has her own spotlight. She just seems like such a star to be in the movie. And I don't know if that's because, like, you recognize her and you go, oh, look, it's Michelle Pfeiffer. Or if it really is because she just was so obviously going to be a big star and she's just sort of like goofing her way through this musical.
Well, I don't think that glow has left her that spotlight. I feel like it follows her with every project. It's just, yeah, she's Michelle Pfeiffer.
She was great earlier this year in the movie French Exit, which was, you know, a bit of a different role for her. She was fantastic in it. It didn't get as much sort of awards attention as maybe it might have. It's worth checking out as well.
One Fine Day. That was one of the first movies I watched again when quarantine was happening. I was like, let me just watch One Fine Day. It's been so long. And it was just perfect. She's perfect. George Clooney's perfect. You should rewatch that.
You know, I also, after I watched Grease 2, I also, you know, also streaming on a similar platform was Tequila Sunrise, this sort of sexy thriller from the late 80s with Michelle Pfeiffer, Kurt Russell, and Mel Gibson. And it, like, I'm not going to say it's a good movie, but it was like an enjoyable, like, cable watch.
Really retro, going back to the 90s.
The Envelope, the podcast, is hosted by me, Mark Olson, and my colleague, Yvonne Villarreal. Our producer is Asal Asanapur, and our executive producer is Abby Ventress-Swanson. Our audio engineer is Mike Heflin. Special thanks to Mike for making our theme song.
Thanks for listening, and see you next week.